Radharshi Vasadi Gaur Bhakti Vrindaki Jai. Shri Shri Radha Krishna Gaur Gopinath Shyamakunda Radha Kunda Giti Govardhan Ki Jai. Vrindavan Dham Ki Jai. Mathura Dham Ki Jai. Navadvip Mayapur Dham Ki Jai. Jagannath Puri Dham Ki Jai. Gangamai Jamuna Devi Ki Jai. Bhakti Devi Ki Jai. Tulsi Maharani Ki Jai. Samaveta Bhakti Vrindaki Jai. Gaur Premananda. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Nama Om Vishnupadaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhujale. Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namane. Namaste Sarasvati Deve Gauravani Pacharane. Nirvisesa Sunyavadi Paskachade Satarane. Mam Deham Sri Guru Sri Yuta Padakamalam Sri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Bitam Sam Sajivam Sadvaitam Sadvadutam Padijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Sri Vishakam Bitamscha Panchakalpa Trubhyascha Kripasindaviyavacha Patichinam Pavanevyo Vaishnavenyo Namo Namaha Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. May 12, 2016, in New Vrindavan, West Virginia, reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 11, Chapter 24, The Philosophy of Sankhya, Text 18. Tad upadaya purvastu bhavo viru bhavo vik urute param adir anto yada yasya Tat satyam abhidhiyate. Which form? Upadaya. Accepting as the ingredient cause. Purvaha. The previous cause, such as the Mahatattva. Two. And. Bhavaha. Thing. Viru. Vik ur rute produces as transformation. Aparam, the second thing, such as the element ahankara. Adhi, the beginning. Antaha, the end. Yada, when. Yasya, of which product. Tat, that cause. Satyam, real. Abhidhiyate is called. All right, so when we're listening to this translation in purport, I want you to try to understand what's happening here. Okay, you could think of this in terms of a space. You try to organize it in a spatial image, perhaps. In a time image, as an essence concept, however it works for you. I want you to try to really meditate, because I'm going to ask all of you what's happening here, what's being described. Translation: a material object, itself composed of an essential ingredient, creates another material object through transformation. Thus, one created object becomes the cause and basis of another created object. A particular thing may thus be called real, in that it possesses the basic nature of another object that constitutes its origin and final state. This is very much related to what we read yesterday. But it's described here differently. Purport. One may understand the purport of this verse through the simple analogy of a clay pot. So starting with a clay pot, if you want to think of it spatially. A clay pot is formed from a lump of clay, which itself is prepared from the earth. In this case, earth is the original ingredient forming the clay lump, and the clay lump is, in a sense, the original cause of the pot. When the pot is destroyed, it will again assume the designation clay and ultimately merge back into the earth, its original cause. In relation to the clay pot, clay is the beginning and final state. Thus, the pot is called real, for it possesses the essential characteristics of clay, which exist before and after the existence of the functioning instrument known as the pot. Similarly, earth exists before and after the clay, and thus clay may be considered real because it possesses the essential characteristics of earth, which exists before and after the existence of the clay. Similarly, earth and other elements are created from the mahatattva, which exists before and after the existence of the elements, which may be considered real because they possess the essential characteristics of the mahatattva. The mahatattva is ultimately the creation of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the cause of all causes, who exists after all is annihilated. The absolute truth is the Supreme Lord himself, who step by step gives meaning and character to all that exists. Yad upadaya purvastu bhavo vikrurute param adhir anto yadayasya tat satyam abhidhiyate. A material object itself composed of an essential element ingredient creates another material object through transformation. Thus, one created object becomes the cause and basis of another created object. A particular thing may thus be called real in that it possesses the basic nature of another object that constitutes its origin and final state. Okay, so you started in the purport with describing a pot, and the pot is made out of? The clay is made out of? The earth is made out of the mahatattva, and the mahatattva is from Krishna. So because the object, the clay pot, has the characteristics of its origin and its destination, right? Origin and destination. Because it has the characteristics of its origin and destination. So the clay pot in the middle, it has the characteristics of clay, which it came from, and again it turns into clay. That if you go down to the clay level, the clay has the characteristics of its origin, earth, and it again becomes earth. Then if you go down to the next level, the earth has the characteristics of the mahatattva, from where it comes and at the end where it goes to. The mahatattva, you go down the next level, it has the characteristics of the Supreme Lord from whom it came from and in whom it merges. Therefore, the clay pot, which comes from the clay, which comes from the earth, which comes from the mahatattva, which comes from God, has the essential nature of God from whom it comes and into whom it goes. Is that clear? So this is about what's real. We have the word here, satyam, that which is real. Satya means reality or truth or goodness. Sat, that which is eternal. So it is satya. And it's interesting, of course, that Krishna, when he talks about what is real, in Bhagavad Gita 2:16, right? He says, nasato. Again, we have this sat, nasato. Nasato vidyate bhavo. Na bhavo vidyate sata. Again, sat. Ubayor api driston tust. Twanios tattva darshi bihi. Tattva darshi bihi, to see the truth. Those who are seers of the truth, tattva darshi bihi, have concluded of the non-existent asat, there is no endurance, and of the existence, there is no cessation. So we have bhava and abhava. Bhava is nature. Thus, seers have concluded by studying the nature of both. So there Krishna is saying, if something is real, it's always its nature. It's always what it is. And if something's nature is changing, then it's not real. So that's how he's defining what's real and what's not real. But here we're saying even something that has a changing nature can be called real, because what it comes from and what it goes to is real in the ultimate sense. Now, if I've already lost you in these first 5 minutes and you couldn't have cared less about what I was talking about, and like, why don't we get to something that applies to my life? I have debts to pay off, and, you know, I'm not feeling too well this morning or something like that, and, you know, my internet wasn't working this morning. If those are our big problems in the world, and we're just like, why in the world should I be concerned about clay pots and clay and earth and mahatattvas and supreme personalities of Godhead and whether something is real or not real? But in relationship to what we are hankering and lamenting about, our sochatis and our kanchatis, right? Charity told me that somebody was really upset because the other day when they opened the door, I was sitting behind it and they bumped into me. And I said, oh, I'd forgotten all about that. So we have our lamentations about the past, right? Why did I do this? Why did I say this? Why did I open the door when somebody was sitting behind it? I wish I hadn't said that, you know? And we have our hankering. When am I going to get this? When am I going to get that? We have our things that we worry about. You know, I don't have enough money, or I have a fight with my spouse, or whatever, my equipment isn't working. And we have the things that we delight in. But if all of these things are unreal, then we're really wasting our time. And if they're real, we're not. So it's a pretty important question. What's real and what's not real? Now, one of the things we learn when we're children is that there's something called dreams. When we're quite little, we learn, oh, there's something called dreams that are not real. So I don't have to be in anxiety about what I dream about. I can just forget about it. How do we determine that our dreams are unreal?
We wake up,
okay. But you could take it the other way. You could take it that what's happening during the day isn't real because I go to sleep and forget about it. So how do we decide that what we dream about as night is unreal, whereas what happens to us during the day is real? Why do we make that distinction? What's the difference?
Because you don't feel anything.
I feel things in my dream. I feel emotions. Don't you feel emotions in your dreams?
Yeah, but you don't feel like if you get hurt, you don't feel hurt, like actually.
Oh, I feel hurt in my dreams. I felt pain in my dreams. I've eaten food in my dreams and tasted the food in my dreams. Because all sensations happened where? Where are all sensations happening? In the mind. I mean, even modern medicine says that. I just read a fascinating article that when we eat food, a lot of what we taste has nothing to do with the chemicals in the food whatsoever. It's not either a taste or a smell. It's in the mind. They were saying even very experienced professional wine tasters, if you put a drop of red color into the white wine, they think it has a different taste. So our sense perception happens entirely in the mind, even if you want to say it's in the brain. But it's not happening with our senses. So therefore, in a dream, you can experience all sense perception.
But they're temporary.
They're temporary, but so is what I do during the day.
But if they're, you know, like, you can, you don't pick up where you left off.
Okay, so there's no continuity. So that's one thing, there's no continuity. That if I do something during the day on Monday, on Tuesday, it's still at that point where I left off. I read a book up to page 10, and my bookmark is still there on Tuesday. Whereas if I dream that I read a book, you ever dreamt that you woke up? I've had dreams like that. I've had a dream that I woke up, and I took a shower, and I got dressed, and I went through a day, and I did stuff. But then when I go back to sleep again, I don't pick up at that point. I dream something completely different, maybe in a different place even. Okay, so there, we have the continuity problem. That's very good. I never thought of that before. What else?
We dream in a different state of consciousness. It's different. We are sleeping and then we are awake.
But again, that's very comparative. So I could say that my waking state of consciousness is the unreal and my dreaming is the real. How do I know which state of consciousness is more real? In fact, if you want to talk about a state of consciousness, Arguably, from the Shastra, you could argue from the Shastra that the dreaming state is closer to the spiritual. Because when Krishna appears to great devotees, he often does so in dreams. And the fourth state of consciousness, called Turiya, which just simply means fourth, is often considered to be the state past deep sleep. That our waking state is the least close to the spiritual, our dreaming state is closer, the deep sleep is even closer, and the final state is beyond deep sleep. And that often it's explained in the Shastra like that, that in our sleeping state, we're actually, because it's more subtle, we're more attuned to reality than we are in our waking state. So that's, one could interpret it that way. That's arguable. We could argue about it, but you could interpret it that way. And in fact, in Dhyan Yoga, when people go into a yogic trance, what they do is something very much like deep sleep. Before going into Samadhi, you do something called Pratyahara. Pratyahara is where you withdraw all of the senses from the sense objects. So you no longer see or hear or touch or smell or taste anything in the world, which is exactly what happens when we go into a deep sleep. The difference being that when we're in a deep sleep, we don't have any awareness of I. We don't have any I-ness awareness. I mean, we do when we wake up, we can say, I slept well. So there's some kind of I-ness that stays in deep sleep, but not that we're aware of. Whereas in Dhyan Yoga, when you go into Pratyahara, you retain the I-ness. But the mind goes to sleep. In the deep yogic trance, the mind is completely quieted, and one is functioning on the platform simply of the intelligence, which isn't flickering. And deeper than that, in the ultimate yogic trance, the intelligence is quieted, and you're functioning on the platform of the ultimate I-ness or the soul. That is the fourth state of consciousness. So yes, it's in a different state of consciousness, but that's not to say that the fact that it's different makes it less real. In fact, it could be making it more real. How else do we say that our dreams are not real and our waking state is real? Yes?
In your wake state, you use your body to do actions, and in your sleeping state, you would, it's...
Okay, you're not acting with the gross body. And because we're very gross beings, we consider that actions performed with the gross body have more meaning than actions that are not performed with the gross body. Why else do we consider dreams unreal in our waking state real? Yes?
This might be the same, but I joke that my mom is a different person.
Okay, so you had dreams of where other people shifted.
Yeah.
You had a different mom and a different dad.
But in reality, I think it's continuity.
That's the continuity problem. But you're talking about other people, and I think that's another thing. That I can dream that I have you over for prasadam and I cook you a meal. But if I say to you, oh, did you enjoy the meal? You say, well, I never went. So a lot of the way that we consider that our waking life is real is that other people share it. So we have the continuity and we have the fact that other people share it. That other people confirm, yes, I did that with you. That actually happened. Of course, that's not a very good indicator of realness. Because we share other things which we all accept as being illusory. For example, we can all go see a movie together, right? And we can all experience that we're seeing the movie, but the events in the movie never happened. I mean, the movie happened, but the events in the movie didn't happen. And people will talk about movies and TV shows that they've seen, right? They'll share, this is one of the problems that devotees who don't use the media find when they go to outside schools and outside workplaces, that people there are talking about the latest movies and the latest TV shows, like our kids who went to public school from Gurukul had this problem. Right? The kids were all talking about these characters and the fictional characters in the shows, and the devotee kids had no idea who they were talking about. Right? My youngest son told me when he started working, he said that he ended up renting all these children's videos like Peter Pan and, Alice in Wonderland, because he didn't know any of these stories, and people would refer to them all the time. And he's just like, how am I going to relate to these people? But my point is we can have a collective illusory experience. And now with computer games, that's actually quite common. That people play computer games and they get another identity in the computer game, and they interact with each other in the game as that identity. Yes, you're all familiar with that? And again, they have a collective experience. I mean, I remember being around teenagers that played a lot of computer games, and they would even speak to each other with their names in the game, you know, in their characters in the game. But it's not real. They're not really collecting gold and fighting monsters, and even though it's a collective experience. So those, you know, the fact that it's collective is not really a good clue as to whether or not it's real. We could all be having a mass hallucination. And continuity also has that same kind of problem. And therefore, philosophers ask, what is real? And it's a pretty big question, because if something isn't real, then it's not meaningful. It doesn't really have any meaning, something that's unreal. The only thing that has meaning is something that's real. And in fact, Krishna talks about the demons, right, in the 16th chapter. And he uses this word, ahankara. Ahankara balim darpam, kamam krodam sasamrishta. Mad atma paradehishu, pravishchanto vayasuyaka. They're bewildered by false ego. Right? They have no sense of what's actually going on. And what do they say? We have this word satya again. Asatyam apratishtam te apratishtam. Without foundation, a stum. We have the word like Kazakhstan, right? Stun, nishta. Sta means to stay, to be stable. Asatyam, apratistam te, jagad ahur anisvaram, aparaspara sambhutam kim anyat kamahoitukam. They say this world is unreal, and that there is no foundation, and that there is no God in control. It is produced of sex desire, and has no cause other than lust. And in fact, this philosophy is very prevalent in the world today, isn't it? That there's no foundation to the world. I mean, even the Christians say that the world came from nothing, which is interesting. So even the most popular religion in the world today, all the varieties of Christianity, they say the world was created from nothing. And the modern evolutionists, they also say at first there was just nothing. From this nothing, all of a sudden there was a chunk, an infinitesimally dense chunk, infinitely small, infinitely dense, which exploded and created all the variety. And somehow on this planet there was the right combination of chemicals just by chance, and somehow a piece of matter became conscious and started to reproduce. And somehow through a series of billions and billions of mistakes, over billions and billions of years, chance mistakes, we are here. But we have no real origin, and we have no real destination. Life is simply unreal. So this is a very prominent philosophy, and if life is unreal, it's very depressing. Peter Berwash was talking about the number of suicides that are increasing, and that we think about the amount of drug use. We were reading about swimming in the river. Krishnadas Kaviraj Prabhu was talking about how everything's polluted, right? Remember that class? So I was thinking one way in which everything's polluted is now people are taking so many psychotropic drugs that it's being excreted in their urine, and the water treatment plants don't have any facility to deal with these medications. And so there's all these medications to affect your mood for mental illness, for depression and so forth, going into the water supply. And also from all the birth control pills and other hormones people are taking, that's going into the water supply. And they're finding that the aquatics are being affected by it. There's a lot of fish now that are being decimated because they're so mellow that they just hang around and get eaten. Really, seriously. You know, they're taking all these, the antidepressants are going into the water, you know, an anti-anxiety medication, and the fish are just like, oh, there's another fish. Hi, fish. Finished, you know. And then there are some species that aren't being able to reproduce much anymore because of all these hormones going into the water. So it's messing up the gender ratio. Mostly it's feminizing the aquatics. They're turning into... males are not developing properly. So why are people taking all of these psychotropic medicines? Why is there this huge increase in mental disturbance? Because people think the world's not real. And there's no basis to anything. There's no meaning to anything. If everything comes from nothing and everything goes to nothing, then everything in the middle is also nothing. Right? That's what this verse is saying. Things are real because they have a real source and they have a real destination. They have a real basis. But if there's no real source and there's no real destination, then there's no real basis for anything. Even if there's continuity, even if there's a collective experience, none of those things make anything real and meaningful. And then it also just doesn't matter what you do. Why should we care about the ecology? Why should I care about my neighbor? Why should I care about my bodily health even? Why should I care about anything? You know, we become basically like very low-level animals that let me just do whatever feels good at the moment, because that becomes the only thing that has any kind of reality. My immediate sense perception. Does this taste good? Does this smell good? Does this feel good? Does this give me some kind of oomph? And then that becomes it. You know, or we go to some nihilistic philosophy where we just become depressed. Nothing means anything anyway. And people try to deal with this problem by artificially creating sentimental sorts of meaning. So such has become very popular today, often in the name of spirituality. You know, well, what means something is if you're just nice to people, try to do some good in the world, try to make the world a better place, right? And they'll make, you know, sentimental books and sentimental movies and little vignettes about how just something to give you some emotion. Right? Something where you cry or you feel, oh yes, that's meaningful. But that doesn't work. Just because I see someone whose legs burned off in a fire and they got artificial legs and they learned how to run anyway, and I think, oh, it doesn't make it any more meaningful. If it's coming from nothing and it's going to nothing, then it's still nothing. No matter how inspiring and how emotive, and you know, you can have some illusory movie or play that's very emotive, yes? It doesn't make it real, it doesn't make it meaningful. So this search for meaning is very much part of the soul, which comes out in the human being. If we can't find meaning, we become depressed, or we try to invent something meaningful. We try to concoct something meaningful. So here the Bhagavatam is saying, Krishna is saying in the Bhagavatam, there is real meaning. There is real meaning even in this world. And in one sense, there's real meaning even to that which Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita isn't real. Because in the Bhagavad Gita, which we were just reading in 2:16, Krishna says you can tell what's real and what's not real by what stays. That, by the way, is also a way in which we try to say whether or not things are real, by how long they stay. Oh, this, you know, the 50th anniversary, for example, I mean, if we're going to be really frank and really radical here, that somehow we feel if ISKCON has a 50th anniversary, it has more value than if it only had a 5-day anniversary. Something that stays for a long time. Or we did this wonderful thing, but it only lasted for a day. Or that doesn't have as much value as something that's lasted for hundreds of years or thousands of years. And we all hope that the things we start in our lifetime are still there when we die. No matter how long something lasts, as soon as it's over, we say, oh, it was a failure just because it ended. We have very much this conception. Does that all make sense to everybody? If you have a 20-year project, after 20 years, it's, oh, it was a failure because it ended. So we tend to see like this, that meaning is in duration. So that's what Krishna's saying. He's saying what's eternal always keeps its same nature. what's real, what's eternal, it always has the same nature. It doesn't end. And anything that changes its nature, it's not real. But here he's saying, this is Krishna talking, here he's saying, even if something's changing its nature and even if something isn't lasting, you can still call it real because it has a real basis and a real end that doesn't change. And that real basis and that real end is always present, even through the changing forms. Does that, you follow that? Everybody follow that? No? Okay, so you could say, these and basis of Bhagavad Gita, 2.16, you could say these cartels are unreal. Because they don't keep the same nature. The nature they have now, the bhava they have now, is not their eternal bhava. It stops, it ends. It had a beginning and it had an end. Therefore, you could say they are unreal. But you can also say, according to today's verse, these are real because what they come from and what they go to remains. Well, you can say, well, wait a minute, you know, they came from a metal and that metal doesn't stay either. Oh, but that comes from the earth. Oh, but the earth doesn't stay either. Oh, that comes from the Mahatattva. Oh, that doesn't stay either. Oh, that comes from Krishna. Oh, that stays. And because it comes from Krishna, which stays, the essential nature of these cartels is of something that doesn't change. There's an unchangeable aspect to these cartels, although their particular form as cartels and the particular way we can use them as cartels does not stay. So we're coming back to the simultaneous one indifference. That the things in this world and our experiences in this world, in one sense, have no reality because they don't stay. Even you have continuity from one day to the next. Nothing we do in this world stays. Nothing we do keeps its same itness. I don't keep my same identity from one life to another, right? Isn't that correct?
Why not?
I don't keep my same identity.
Why
don't I keep my same identity? Oh, now we're going to go off on a branch.
No.
Okay, we can go off on a branch as long as we come back. That's that's fine. Well, no, because when I came from my last body, in my last body, believe me, in my last body, I was not a white American woman.
But the essence.
Well, the sense of existence remains.
Karma,
yes. But my identity, I am a this, you know, my dad's name was Bernard. That wasn't true in my last life. My dad's name wasn't Bernard in my last life.
Cartels are used for
sex. Oh, no, you're jumping. Just wait.
No, but I
that you're jumping,
I
and we have.
A lot of stuff you said. I've never read it. The Bhagavatam.
I just read it here, Prabhu. I'm just right out of the Bhagavatam.
No, but then you're going into other stuff.
What did I say that wasn't out of the Bhagavatam or the Bhagavad Gita?
Well, the Bhagavatam also says that the dream-like existence, is a dream. Sukadeva Goswami says that that's the secret understanding to the fourth canto.
That all of life is.
Life is when you serve your Krishna, when you have something to do with Krishna.
But we didn't get there yet.
I don't know, you've been all over the place.
You think I've been all over the place?
So many of the things you say, I don't agree with.
Tell me one thing.
I said it.
Tell me one thing I said that you think isn't right. Okay, but my sense of material identity changes from body to body, doesn't it?
I don't agree with that.
So when I have an ego body, I'm not thinking I'm an ego?
No, you have that body because of something you did previously.
But isn't that a sense of identity that's changing?
I don't think so. I think the identity is the same. It's just an illusion, and because of that illusion, you take all these other bodies.
Okay, but don't you have an illusory identity that's changing? Sometimes there's some continuity. That's a very good point. But as far as my sense of identity in illusion, that's always changing.
Yeah, because it's an illusion.
Exactly. That's exactly the point. Anything that's always changing, Krishna says, that doesn't keep its same nature, is an illusion. That's what Krishna says, Bhagavad Gita 2:16. He says, how do you know something's an illusion? It's always changing. How do you know something is real? It remains the same. So how do I know that my illusory identity is illusion? Because it's always changing. Just like even in this life, when I was 3 years old, I didn't have an identity of being someone's mother. That's changing. It wasn't until I was older that I had an identity, oh, I'm somebody's mother. And at that time, it's an illusion because it's always changing. It's not so superficial because when you have an identity that I'm someone's mother, that dictates a lot of your activities, doesn't it? My activities made a huge shift when I had the identity of I am a mother to the identity of I'm not a mother. I had a completely different set of activities.
But isn't that just an illusion?
Yes, that's the whole point.
She might have been imagining that last night.
Exactly. That is the whole point. So why here in today's verse is Krishna saying that even though something changes its identity and changes its nature and changes its use, can you still call it as real? So here Krishna says if something's changing its bhava, its nature, it's an illusion. And here Krishna says even those things that change their bhava and change their identity are still called real. That seems to be contradictory. Does this make sense? It doesn't make sense. Okay, so we're trying to make some sense out of this. So why is it real? It's real because there is an unchanging aspect to it. What's an illusion is the changing aspects, and what's real is the unchanging. And I like what you brought up. That even in my last life, if I was an eagle flying around, or maybe I was a vulture, I don't know, I probably was just a vulture, not an eagle. But let's say in my last life I was a vulture, there was something that stayed from that life to this life. And what was that?
The soul.
The soul, that sense of I exist. How I defined my I was very different. The activities I had on the basis of that I were very different. Those were the changing things that are an illusion. But the sense of I-ness doesn't change. And therefore that is real. So in the cartels, as cartels, as in, these are not eternally cartels. But the essential thing from which they are made, which is ultimately God, that is real. Yes, Prabhu.
Clay pot.
Yes.
Earth. And these are things that we can see.
Yes.
Then we start talking about Mahatattva.
And Krishna, we can't perceive that.
We can't perceive. And that's one question. The other question is when Krishna's talking in the ninth chapter about by my unmanifested form, this entire universe is created.
Yes.
When I used to read that, I used to think, well, that's referring to Brahmajyoti, the Mahatattva. Mm.
Well, I'd say the answer to your question is given by Sanatana Goswami in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita, where Gopa Kumar goes through the different layers of the universe. And he comes to the layer first of earth. Now, earth just means solid matter. But still, there's a world there. And Bhumi Devi's there worshipping. Who does she worship there? Who's Bhumi's lord? Lord Varaha. And then there's the realm of water, and then of fire, and then of air, and then of ether. Then there's a realm of false ego, and mind, and intelligence. And finally, there's the realm of Prakriti, which Sanatana Goswami describes as very subtle, And it says it contains the subtle basis of all sense enjoyment. We were saying how our sense perception actually happens in the mind, not in the senses, yes? So in this layer of Prakriti, Sanatana Goswami explains, all of our subtle sense perceptions are there. And he says there's sense pleasures thousands and thousands of times greater than even on Brahma's planet, as you go through each of these layers. And there is Prakriti Devi herself, Maya Devi. And she says to Gopakumara, I am the sister of Vishnu, and you cannot go past me and enter into the Brahman and then to Vaikuntha without my permission. And there were entities in that sphere enjoying the pleasures there in the Prakriti. So that's pretty inconceivable, isn't it? I also understand, though, that the Mahatattva and the Pradhan, things have been broken up so that you don't even find the modes of material nature. Because when Mahavishnu glances at the Mahatattva, his glance is what? Yeah, but what is the glance that impregnates the material nature? Well, it's time. It's time, and it's Lord Shiva. And when this glance of time and Lord Shiva touches the Pradhan, the Mahatattva, then it starts separating into the modes. You could think of it like white light that you could then separate into the different colors of the spectrum. But you look at it, it's just white. So the Mahatattva, the Pradhan, is just, it's diffused. There's no differentiation between anything. And solids, liquids, gases, radio, there's no differentiation. I mean, I sometimes think, I don't know if this is accurate, but like the scientists say things are made of atoms, and the atoms are made of protons, neutrons, and electrons. And perhaps the Pradhan is just protons, neutrons, and electrons that aren't attached to each other, that are just kind of floating around. They haven't joined to perform, to create any of the elements. But it's still the stuff. It's some kind of stuff. It also has to form mind, intelligence, and false ego, not just earth, water, and air. So it's all whatever stuff that is, all undifferentiated. As if you could take a cake and unmake it. You know, turn it back into the flour and the water, and then you could take those and unmake it. You could take the hydrogen and the oxygen of the water and unmake that, and then you could go into the oxygen and unmake the atom. You know, and go into the hydrogen and unmake the atom and turn it back into just its most fine parts that can't be unmade anymore. So if we're going to be dealing in our daily life and we want to do something that's meaningful, is that all right? Does that answer you as much as it can possibly be answered? Perhaps at this particular moment in time, hopefully you'll find somebody who can answer it better at some other point in time. So if we want to come to the real essence of reality and meaning, we have to come to that which doesn't change its nature. Now, we can use these cartels in Krishna's service. I can use this body in Krishna's service. I can use my temporary identity in Krishna's service. I can be a good brahmachari for Krishna, or a good mother for Krishna, or a good whatever for Krishna. I can use this room for Krishna. Ultimately, to have real meaning, I have to come to the thing that doesn't change. Just being an American for Krishna, or an Indian for Krishna, or a mother for Krishna, or a son for Krishna, is not enough. I have to go to that which doesn't change. I have to really go to Krishna himself. I have to see that Krishna is there in everything, to see that essential principle. And this is, of course, what the Mahabhagavatas see. The Mahabhagavatas, as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu explained to Ramananda Roy, when Ramananda Roy said to Lord Chaitanya, you know, you're Krishna. Lord Chaitanya said, oh, you see Krishna everywhere. He says, the Mahabhagavatas, they don't see the form of things. Of course, they do see the form of things. Otherwise, the Mahabhagavata couldn't play a pair of cartels if they didn't see the form of things at all. But they don't really see this as cartels. They really see the essence that it's Krishna. And they come to their unchanging essence. That's what we're supposed to do. This is self-realization. We're supposed to go beyond just, well, I'm a good, you know, this for Krishna, and I can be a this for Krishna, and I can use we had our management meeting talking about using our material talents for Krishna. I can use these talents for Krishna, this nature. We should go beyond that to what is our real unchanging nature. Who am I ultimately? Who am I that has remained constant through all of my bodies? What is the essence of what I'm doing? And only when we come to that point are we going to have a life that's really full of meaning and realness. That will include using everything in Krishna's service, but using everything in Krishna's service is not the ultimate end. Because if I just stop at using everything in Krishna's service, I can still maintain the mentality of false identities. Do you all understand that? If I'm just fixed on I'm using this chair in Krishna's service, and I'm using this American body in Krishna's service, I'm using the fact that I speak English in Krishna's service, then I'm still fixed on I am a English-speaking woman, this is a chair. I'm still fixed on that, which is a huge, huge jump and a huge, huge, huge step towards perfection. And we have to go deeper still as to who am I that doesn't change. Who is that person? To wake up that person, not just in a general way, I'm a soul, but to wake up into, of course you can't do this, we can't force this, but this is where we have to be going, this is what we have to be desiring. To wake up as to who I am eternally. What is my eternal service? What is the eternal basis of all of the things and the people that I'm dealing with? And as devotees come to that point, then all of our relationships take on a completely different quality. If I'm relating with you not as our temporary identities, but in terms of our eternal identities. And this is what we're supposed to come to in the Hare Krishna movement. We're supposed to come to this point where we wake up to our eternal identities. Again, that can't be forced. It's grace. But at least we have to be desiring that and going to that. And then we'll be living in the reality all the time. As Prabhupada quotes all the time, the great devotees, they see everything, but they don't exactly see their forms. They see that there is Krishna. When they see another living being, they see, oh, this body is simply a temple of Krishna. It's simply made up of Krishna's energy. And they see that other living entity as a servant of Krishna. And until and unless we come to that point, we are going to be very frustrated at trying to find a meaningful life. We will either get depressed and discouraged, or we will concoct some sort of sentimental meaning out of things. We will look for meaning in material longevity. You know, we'll look for meaning in material emotiveness, which is the way that people, basically those are the two ways that people try to find meaning, materially. How long something lasts, and to what extent it brings out some material emotions. And we'll look for meaning in those ways, none of which will really satisfy us. Now we can at least practice so that Krishna will give us the grace to awaken us, because as I said, you can't force it, you can't imagine it. By at least on the intellectual level and as much as we can on the heart level, to try to deal with the world like that. Not just using things in Krishna's service instead of for our sense gratification, as Prabhu so nicely pointed out. That's essential. And going a step beyond that. How is Krishna here? Where is the essence? Now we do this a lot when we talk about, oh, something is Krishna's arrangement, where we see Krishna's hand behind something, yes? It's a wonderful opulence we have in our ISKCON society, that we see that behind everything that happens, Sarvakarana Karana, which is very much what this verse is about, that Krishna is the cause of all causes. And we can also do that by meditating on the fact that everybody is an eternal soul, all living entities. And that ultimately everything is made up of our own beloved Lord Krishna. So I hope this wasn't too controversial of a class. Or too philosophical. Yes?
So your point was maybe to show us a chinta veda veda tatha, how what you can do and what things we do there, and how and I guess the other point is that real meaning comes from Krishna.
Yes. Yes. Oh, we talked a little bit more about a chinta veda veda tatha yesterday than today. But today I wanted to focus on how, because this sat, we're talking about here about sat, what's real. So I wanted to really to focus on that. How do we find meaning? Isn't that one of the needs that psychologists say that we have? A need for meaning? And again, materially, you have to just kind of invent your own way in which things become meaningful to you. Yes? We're actually very much an illusion.
So, the example of Arjuna and Krishna, I mean, doesn't Krishna say, well, you're a kshatriya and our duty isn't to go? Like, how do we understand what our duty
oh,
is?
Oh, what a wonderful question.
Can you rephrase the question?
Okay, she was saying, and if I get this wrong, let me know, that I said that if we identify with our temporary body and stuff, that that's an illusion. But yet Arjuna in the battlefield of Kurukshetra had Krishna telling him, you're a kshatriya and therefore you have to get up and fight, right? That's a very good question. So this is answered very much in the sixth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna says, for those who are beginners, then work is the mean, and for those means, and for those who are advanced, cessation of all material activities is said to be the means. So for a beginner in bhakti yoga, you say, you are a singer. Sing for Krishna. You are a warrior. Fight for Krishna. You are a well-placed politician in the Indian parliament. Use your political influence for Krishna. You are a mother. Raise your children in Krishna consciousness. And that, and you end there. That's all you can do. So that's very much in the beginning of Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna says things to Arjuna like, for one who's been honored, dishonor is worse than death. People will speak ill of you. You have such a great family. They'll criticize you. And very soon after that, what does Krishna say about honor and dishonor? Huh?
Give it up.
Don't care about honor and dishonor at all. Be equipoised in honor and dishonor. Well, what is that? First, Krishna's telling me I have to uphold the great names of my mother's and father's family. And Krishna's telling me that people will call me a coward and I'll be dishonored. And he's trying to bring out this Rajagun. And then he says, rise above the modes of nature. And how many times does Krishna say in the Bhagavad Gita, be equipoised to honor and dishonor, fame and infamy? Several times. So one's an instruction on a lower platform and one's an instruction on a higher platform. I don't know if I should say this, it's so politically controversial, but anyway, I'm stupid that way. So the devotees were complaining to Srila Prabhupada, they didn't want to chant japa in the temple room with the women. The men were complaining. There were 15 years in ISKCON when the women weren't allowed to chant japa in the temple room. And they were complaining. And Prabhupada says, you know, why can't you be a pandit? Vidya vinaya sampane brahmane govi hastani suni chaiva sapandita suni chaiva sapakacha pandita samadarshina. Why can't you have this samadarshina? Why can't you see everyone as equal? And then he says, or see the women as your mother. He said, what's your problem? Can't you chant with your mother? So there, Prabhupada first gave a higher thing and then jumped to a lower one. He said, you know, just see them as souls. Why can't you just see that they're not the body? Oh, you can't do that. You see them as the body. Okay, see them as your mother. That way you won't become disturbed. At Krishna, the 12th chapter, he says, you know, just love me. Just think of me with love. Oh, you can't do that. We'll do the regulation of sadhana. You can't do that, work for me. You can't do that, okay, then give up the results of your actions or meditate. So Krishna says this often, you know, you should surrender to me. But some people surrender to the demigods, some people surrender to the Brahman. And I've also generated Varnashram if you want to do that. So he has all these different levels. So as beginners, we may have to say, okay, I am a this. I am a black American man who has a wife and three kids, and therefore I'm going to be a black American man with a wife and three kids for Krishna. But we don't want to stay on that platform. That's the Prakriti devotee, the materialistic devotee. And so many times Prabhupada would say, don't stay on that platform. You can start on that platform. That's a huge jump from just being a materialist. I'm a black American man with three kids, and my purpose is to enjoy my wife and kids and be happy in the world. If you go from there, you know, I'm going to be a good husband for Krishna, and I'm going to be a good father for Krishna. That's great. But what about who am I? Who am I really? How can I be who I really am for Krishna instead of just my play acting roles for Krishna? Yes?
So when Krishna says that Dhyana Maharaj is a religious to me, is he referring, he uses the word religion, is he referring just to like theological belief systems about God, or is he referring to like anything that we consider, we adore, anything that we worship with adoration, like be it?
Well, he's using the word dharma. Sarva dharma parichaya. Give up all kinds of dharma. And dharma has to do with identity. So he's ultimately saying to Arjuna, don't fight this war because you want to be a good kshatriya who's going to be honored and respected, and you're doing your duty as a kshatriya, and if you win, you'll get the earth, and if you die, you'll go to heaven. Give that up. Fight this battle just because I want you to fight this battle. Just because of your eternal relationship with me as my friend. Because sometimes they're Naranarayan Rishi. They're not Krishna and Arjuna as kshatriyas. Yes? Sometimes they're as brahmanas. And as Naranarayan Rishi, that same jiva as Arjuna has a different external role to play. And Krishna says, forget about your, you know, you don't do it for that reason. Fight. As if you were fighting as a kshatriya. People will look at you and say, oh, he's fighting because he's... But that's not what's driving you. What's driving you is that you're my eternal friend and you just want to please me and surrender to me. So that's quite a different experience for the living entity internally. And I like to talk about it as the secret agent principle. I just read this story of these brothers in America who found out that their parents were Russian agents. And they hadn't a clue the whole time they were growing up. They found out when they were in their 20s that their parents were actually Russian secret agents. So when we come to our real identity, we become like that. We become really a secret agent. And Rupa Goswami says, you know, the woman who has another lover, she's even more careful to take care of her household affairs so that her husband won't suspect. So when the devotee starts to awaken, oh, I'm Krishna's lover, I'm Krishna's friend, I'm Krishna's mother, I'm Krishna's father. I'm not really a politician. I'm not really, you know, the agriculturalist. I'm not really the temple president. I'm not really any of those things. I'm really, you know. Then they start meditating on being whatever they awaken to, being a cowherd boy with Krishna, let's say. And then they're really taking care of their temple or their family or their job because they love Krishna as their cowherd boyfriend, not because they identify with their job or their family at all. And only when we come to that point are we real. And only when we come to that point does everything actually have meaning. Because then it's on the platform of that which doesn't change, of our eternal nature. And then the changing roles that we do have reality, as in this verse today, because we see they're flowing from and going to our eternal nature. But it's in our eternal nature that's underlying everything. I, as a servant of Krishna in a particular mood, Krishna as my beloved Lord in a particular mood, my eternal relationship with Krishna. And that's the cause and the effect. That's what everything comes from and what everything goes to, and is the song underneath everything. As Prabhupada says, the whole world is full of Krishna's singing. And then I may exhibit in this particular life, at this particular place, in this world, that I appear to have a different identity and a different role and a different nature that I'm using for Krishna, but one should be constantly aware of who one really is. Is that all right? And what you brought up, this is really a side point, but what you brought up is something very important when we study the Shastra. That the vast majority of the statements in the Shastra are contextual. If you take Krishna's instruction to Arjuna, that for one who's been honored, dishonor is worse than death, get up and fight because you'll enjoy either the earth or the heavenly planet, if we take that out of context, we would end up with a very materialistic religion, wouldn't we? So the majority of the instructions of the Lord himself are said in a particular context. They are perfect and absolute in that time, place, and circumstance. It's one of the 14 items of knowledge to understand time, place, and circumstance and act accordingly. And because things are generally contextual, there are some statements in the Shastra that are trans-contextual. But because things are generally contextual, we end up with these seeming contradictions, where something is said in one place and it's seemingly the opposite it says in another place. Just like one devotee told the story that Prabhupada said to him, "You're eating too much, you should reduce." And the devotee said to Prabhupada, "But Prabhupada, when I first came, you told me to eat a lot." And Prabhupada said, "Did you believe me then?" He said, "Yes." He said, "So believe me now." So if you just take those two instructions, you say, why is Prabhupada contradicting himself? But he's not contradicting himself. In each case, he was giving a perfect instruction in that context. So it's essential, and Vaisheshika brought this up in his class, that whenever we look at anything in the Shastra, we look at what's happening. Who's speaking to whom? What's going on here? What is the context? And how is this a perfect, absolute truth in that context? But some statements are trans-contextual. Manmana bhavabhad bhaktal. That's a trans-conceptual statement. Or mam ekam sharanam vraja. And therefore we have people like Bhaktivinoda Thakur who come up with this dasmula tattva. What are the trans-contextual statements? It doesn't matter who you are, it doesn't matter where you are, it doesn't matter what you're doing. They're always perfectly and totally applicable. Does that make sense to you? Yeah, if you don't do that, you just... People who don't understand that things are... That part of knowledge is it has to be time, place, and circumstance. They may talk about taking the Shastra literally, but they can't. They'll end up favoring one thing over another, and they're blind to the fact that they're doing that. So to be really intelligent applicators of the Shastra, we need to take that fact into account. So I think we've gone over time. Did you have something that you wanted to ask? Because we are...
kind of asked, but I want to get the clarification that it seems like while we are trying to awake our identity, we need to follow the context. We need to see what our situation
yes.
is now, and we need to follow the etiquette and the context.
Yes.
Otherwise, it just causes social disturbance.
Absolutely. And you'll find that even when someone has awakened, they generally still do that. Yes. In fact, we talk about this in a chapter in the book we just published, Raghunath Das Goswami's Mana Shiksha, how there's the outer path of spontaneous love and the inner path of spontaneous love. On the outer path, which was taught to Vakeshwara Pandit by Swarup Damodar, when a person starts to awaken their eternal identity, they withdraw from society, they give up all of their occupations on the external level, they go to the holy dham and they just sit and chant a bunch of mantras and do a bunch of meditation. That's the external path, which can become easily twisted and perverted. Someone can say, "Oh yeah, you're ready, go sit at Radha Kund and chant these mantras." But the internal path is given by Raghunath Das Goswami, which was given also to him by Swarup Damodar, and is the path that was favored by Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati and our Srila Prabhupada. Is externally, you go on as if you're not an awakened soul. You don't change your external activities. Maybe slightly, but in ways that would hardly be perceptible to anybody else. I mean, we are enjoined by Rupa Goswami that once we awaken to our eternal identity, we should spend more time on the angas of bhakti that nourish that identity and less on the angas that don't. But that's not going to be very perceptible externally to anybody else. And the real change happens internally. So, and of course, this is the kind of way that Krishna is talking to Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita. Externally, you're acting as a kshatriya, and you're acting as the prince, and you're, but internally, your consciousness is completely changed. So that is, of course, there are aspect bona fide practices of bhakti yoga following in the line of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. There are bona fide that would involve, okay, now I'm going to become a babaji, and I leave my family, and I leave my work, and I just go sit at Radhakund, and I there. That's bona fide, but it's not what we're recommending, basically, because that can be imitated, it can be twisted, and it became, in fact, imitated and twisted and perverted. And it causes a disturbance to others because they think that that's the means rather than a symptom of the goal. They think if I do that artificially, I'll become advanced, rather than that may be a symptom of someone who's already advanced. So we follow the inner path, which can't be imitated, and it can't be perverted, it just can't be because it's happening inside. And as we awaken to our eternal identity, it appears to everybody else that we're just going on the same. Which is why people have criticized ISKCON and Srila Prabhupada and Bhaktisiddhanta and saying, oh, you're not teaching spontaneous love for Krishna. Because your followers aren't going and becoming Radhakund Babajis and saying 4 hours of mantras every day. You understand? Let's say you're not teaching the real deal. So we really do need to end here. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.